Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, Greg Everett in the house, episode 166 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. This one is awesome, probably going to be the most awesome one ever because we have our long-term friend, Eva Twardokens, in the house today. Eva, what's going on?
Oh, well, I'm not sure if I'm listening or really on this thing. I'm stoked.
Dude, it's going to be weird when you do your normal walks listening to the show. You'll be listening to yourself. So.
I'll be walking in circles.
Well, in case people have been under a rock and they don't know about Eva, Eva is a two-time Olympian in alpine skiing, a 12-year veteran of the U.S. ski team. She's won six national championships, a bronze medal at the world championship level. She was just inducted into the Skiing and Snowboard Hall of Fame. And as if that was not all enough, Eva also won a Masters Olympic Weightlifting Championship about a year ago.
So keep busy.
That was 07, though.
The O-lifting
guild is? Don't talk back, Eva. You're not off to a good start.
Dude, yeah, my wife is the one that split hairs. You can't do that, so.
No, that was 07, but my girls won last year.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah. So not only has she established herself as an athlete in Olympic weightlifting, but she's doing pretty darn well as a coach, too.
Yeah, I'm nice. Not at the Greg Everett level, but I'm trying.
Dude, who is? I mean.
I'm trying to get people rolling. Nice. I'm rolling the ball towards his direction, and then when they get there, he can take care of them.
Very cool. Cool. Yeah. So with Eva, we're going to talk about Eva's history as a top of the food chain Olympic athlete. She was one of the early folks that got involved with CrossFit and a really interesting history with all that. And now Eva is kind of branching out and doing her own flavor of strength and conditioning, has some really interesting insights with this kind of finding a balance on the whole performance, health, longevity kind of trade-off and spectrum. That's kind of the big picture for the show. But before we jump in, we'll talk about our show sponsors really quickly. We have Evolve Foods. It's kind of funny. People keep emailing Greg and I, and they're like, "So I'm not sure what Rob's saying.
Evil foods,
Ev foods or something." So think about what we're usually talking about, which is usually evolutionary biology type stuff. So evolvefoods.com. You can go there, get some great chow. Wellborn has developed some supplements. If you're more on the power athlete spectrum, those things are pretty solid. Evolve Foods, our affiliate software is still broken, so I can't actually provide a link myself as of yet for that. Frontdeskhq.com, if you run a service-based business, a CrossFit gym, yoga, Pilates, stroller strides, dog walking, almost anything where you interface with, paying individuals, need to schedule appointments, track appointments, take billing. Front Desk HQ is your mobile app solution for that. And then we are rolling out a new sponsor today, the Performance Menu Magazine, the Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. The Performance Menu is sneaking up on Greg. Where are we going to be on the
our 100th issue.
100th issue.
May 1st.
And
crazy. So this is year 9 of publishing.
Wow.
Yeah. Honestly, it doesn't seem possible, but it is. I've done the math several times.
Good man. Greg and I both graduated from Chico State, so any type of statistical analysis we provide can typically be
plus or minus 200 to 300%.
Exactly. Numbers. So Performance Menu is a phenomenal resource whether you're looking at paleo nutrition. Scotty Hagness has been a longtime contributor to the Performance Menu. We have MMA articles, boatloads of Olympic lifting and power sport, oriented material. So check that out. We'll have a banner link in the show notes because we're getting all kinds of jiggy on this advertising stuff. So Performance Menu. And Eva, what's going on?
I am here. I am present.
Where is here? Like you're all over the planet. Like, are you traveling right now? You in Baja? Are you in Santa Cruz? Where on the planet are you?
I am still in recovery mode. I'm still, getting my feet on the ground after being in Baja for two weeks.
Gotcha.
At Christmas time, and it's incredibly cold. It's 28 degrees here in Santa Cruz, so I am at home.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's cold.
And that's like 28 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah, not Polish. Not Polish.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Not Polish.
No, it's degrees. Cold. No, it's cold. It's I was out and about last night, and I could not believe that I was in Santa Cruz. It's really like mountain air here.
Wowzers. Yeah, Reno, the high the other day was 20 and the low was 6.
Yeah, that's why I live here.
Yeah, it's pretty chilly. So, yeah, cool. So you're just getting back. So, Eva, tell people a little bit about, like, do you want to talk about your, you know, how your parents kind of shoehorned you into this whole kind of skiing, you know, gig? And they have kind of an interesting story, even with their athletic background. Do you want to talk about that at all? Or what?
No, I'll talk about it. No, thank you. No, well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people recently, my father and I were talking about, you know, genetics versus conditioning. Mm-hmm. And I think we were talking about a book. Oh, what is it? Anyway, and I said, Dad, it was good. It'll come to me.
It has a front cover and a back cover. It has there's material in between. It's amazing.
There's pages. Hey, come on, stop it. Anyway, so I said, Dad, when do you think I started skiing? And he said, well, I think at minus 8 months. And I said, really? He said, yeah, your mom skied with you, and she'd probably get arrested for it these days. She skied with you through your whole, you know, through her whole pregnancy. And
hey, it's not overhead squats with you on your chest.
No, I know. She probably in this day and age, she probably would have really gotten some flack for that. But, you know, I always wonder if as a little fetus, if I could feel the movement, you know, and feel sure. the speed. And, you know, that's an interesting question that I won't answer. But, and then, you know, they worked as ski instructors, and my mom was a college racer, and my dad just had this passion for skiing. And when I was 3 years old, you know, they didn't have children. Dates me so much, but they didn't have children's skis and children's bindings. So my mom found children's skis, but she made bindings out of shelf holders and just, you know, put like leather straps over my feet. They went and taught skiing, and they put me on the little flat area at the ski area. And I just walked around on my skis at 3 years old. And wow. then at 4 years old, I was already skiing around. And they took me to this thing called Interski in Vail. And there were pictures of me skiing when I was 4. And I never really realized, you know, how little I was until my mom took the ski suit out that I was wearing for that little photo shoot. And it's, I mean, it looks like a onesie. It's
right.
Well, that's what ski suits are, right?
Right.
They're just, you know, really, really expensive onesies.
They are, except with no
spider webs on them.
Right. So, yeah. And then, you know, they are Eastern Bloc folks. They're from Poland. So it's like, Wiewilski and Juwilski. It's like, you can't stay home and play Barbies, you know. I always ask, can we not go skiing this weekend? So, you know, every weekend and wherever I had the opportunity, they had me on the mountain. They had me moving. I think for the most part, when I was little, my dad wasn't really too stoked on having kids. But once I, you know, came out of the bag, he was like, well, this is a science project now.
Right, we'll make some lemonade out of that. Yeah, so we'll talk about your dad a little bit because he was a professor here at the university in Reno. Interestingly, yep. And there's some interesting background with that. So, and both of your parents were pretty high-level athletes themselves, right?
Yes, my father is an Olympian. He was a fencer, and he went to the Helsinki Games in 1952. And in 1957 or 58, I always get my hands slapped for not knowing this year, he came to the United States for the World Championships in Philadelphia, and he won a bronze medal, so I didn't one-up him. But and he had the plan. He had it in his head when he came in for that competition that he was going to leave Poland. Mm-hmm. And my mom was supposed to, at the same time, take a cruise into Denmark, and she was not going to go back either. So they had a long-term plan to leave Poland at that time. And his worked and hers didn't. And she couldn't get over for 3 years. They weren't too happy with either of them. And to punish them, they kind of held her back from making the trip to the States. And finally, they let her go after 3 years. But they were newlyweds, so that's kind of a rough go in the beginning of a marriage.
Seriously. And then your mom was a sprinter?
They met in Europe. They have the college they went to was a sports college. And so they did every sport. I mean, they were educated in anatomy and physiology and the sciences, but at the same time, they were doing gymnastics, sailing. My dad was fencing, and they, you know, had their quarters weren't like seasons. Their quarters were sports seasons. You know, in the fall, you're going to sail, and in the winter, you're going to do gymnastics, and in the spring, you're going to do track and field. And so they were busy doing all different types of sports that were mandatory in their college education.
Wow. So, you know, and that's some of that, you know, when Mel Siff would talk about like the GPP, every once in a while you can get Romanov talking about it too, you know, that, you know, the GPP was so woven into like the physical education elements of these Eastern Bloc kids and provided this really amazing kind of background. There's still this great video of the Polish Olympic lifting team, these big dudes, like, you know, 105, 110 kilos doing front hand springs and all this stuff up and down the mats as part of their warm-up sequence.
Yeah, I don't even think that they considered GPP because it was just part of their life. Right. You know, the only thing left was to specialize, and that's kind of what they were preparing you for, is to have this fantastic base, and then you move forward to either teach a specialty or perform at a specialty.
Interesting. Yeah. So tell folks a little bit with the weird connection with the whole paleo scene and your dad.
Well, I make a joke that my dad started the whole paleo scene because Lauren Cordain and my father were lifeguards together at Sand Harbor at Lake Tahoe, and they stirred up trouble every summer. My dad packed his bags and he came home once a week, and she just, you know, gave him new food. Actually, maybe she started it. And what she would give him for food is sardines and applesauce. Just here you go. And Lauren at that time, he'll probably kill me for this, was eating beans and rice. And my dad had a great physique. You know, he was the oldest guy in the bunch, and they had to do, you know, surfboard paddling, you know, timing and, you know, the whole lifeguard spiel before they went on the stand. And dad was right in there. And I don't know, I think that might have flipped a switch. And Lauren, you know, here's this guy, he's 15 years older than me, he's got better body composition, and he's eating sardines and applesauce. And so that's my theory on where Lauren started getting his interest in nutrition, that his best friend was smoking him at an older age and eating these funky things.
That's hilarious. And, yeah. and so that's where they first kind of met, but then Lauren ended up finishing his PhD under your dad at the University of Reno, right?
Yes. Well, he did his degree in physiology, and my father was hoping that he would continue in that direction. And then he did nutrition, which, I mean, if you saw my dad's face when that happened, he just wrinkled his nose like, oh my God, what are you doing? I was your mentor, and now you're going into nutrition? And
pseudoscience.
And
this is not part of the plan,
this
Lauren.
This is not part of the plan. So this is not objective. So anyway, you know, Lauren went on and did great, obviously, and is kind of the king of paleo and the father of paleo, I guess I should say. And I mean, to this day, my dad's like, duh, that's just all, yeah, he's just, that's all smoke and mirrors. And I have to say, Dad, you know, you helped contribute to this, you know, be positive about it. And he's better. I think he just couldn't believe it.
Right.
That Lauren, his buddy, you know, he was the best man at Lauren's wedding, got so famous in nutrition. And I think it's just almost, you know, just unbelievable for him that this happened.
That's awesome. That's hilarious. So your parents had you out on some skis at like age 3, age 4. When did you first start doing some competitive skiing?
Back in the day, when I was 8 years old, my mom entered me in a freestyle contest. And so a freestyle contest in those days, which was in the 70s, was basically a mobile run, and usually at that time ski areas weren't quite ready to build jumps, so we didn't have aerials yet, but we did simple like ballet. And for those skiers out there, we did what we call outriggers and crossovers and Royal Christies, and just, you know, you're kind of on this flat hill and you're crossing your legs and you're uncrossing your legs and you're skiing on one leg and doing a pistol on your skis on one leg while you're skiing.
So for people like Greg who are really into you know, ice dancing, and that's kind of their focus. So did you have anything like a triple Lutz or something like that?
I actually did do, when I got better later on, I started doing axles. So, you know, you'd bet with your legs crossed with skis on.
Wow.
So think about the falls, what those looked like. So, right. And not at speed. So it was kind of like you really dug a nice big hole in the snow and you fell from those. But you'd cross your legs, you'd plant your poles in the snow, and you'd jump and you'd try to get, you know, rotation in and then land with your legs crossed and then step out of it. So, yeah.
Sounds like a terrible idea.
Thinking back, I'm like, thank God I was so young and flexible, because it's like, let's see how much I could tie myself in a knot and then untie myself.
Right.
On snow with sharp things in your hands and strapped to your feet. So that was the beginning. And I did freestyle contests. You know, there weren't a lot. My biggest memory of freestyle contests that when it did get big, I would always have to forerun, but the other forerunners were always streakers. And I remember being like 7 and 8 years old, like hiding behind the thing, because I just knew like the streaker was going to go before me. And sometimes they go after me, so I'd have to watch them from the bottom. And it was just like, oh, you can't make stuff like that up.
So So we're not talking good naked in this case, like.
Imagine a guy with like a head bandana on, like a freaking hairy chest, his junk flying all over the place with just ski boots and skis, going down a mobile run and like doing spread eagles and stuff. And I would look at my mom and look at the guy, and I'd look at her like, is it okay for me to be looking at this? And she would just be laughing like, this is life, girl, just whatever. She would laugh at me because I'd hide. I'd get embarrassed.
Wow.
So then I, at about 12 years old, I started racing, and I really loved racing. And there were times where I did a ski race in the morning, like a slalom in the morning, and then I would do a freestyle event in the evening, because they did it at night sometimes at Boreal. And it got to be a lot, and I don't know why my mom didn't get tired, but I did. And finally I said, Mom, at 12, I said, can I retire from freestyle? And I won the junior nationals that year in freestyle, and I asked her if I could retire after that. And she said yes, and I said, I just want to focus on racing. And then just focused on racing, you know, made the U.S. ski team at 16 years old, and the rest was history. And I was on the team until I was, 29, and took my run at it.
Long career, man. so we'll talk a little bit about some of your specific career highlights and some injuries and stuff like that. But just as an aside, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Eva was she shot me an email or a phone call. I forget what it was, and she's like, "Hey, man, I'm selling my WRX. Do you want to buy it?" And I was like, "Ah, it's a cool car. Maybe I'll do that." And then you know, I sat and thought about it for a little while. I'm all, so buy a rally car from a chick who's used to going down ski slopes at nearly 100 miles an hour. Like, no, I think I'll pass. That thing's probably got some pretty good mileage on it.
She didn't drive that thing easy. Well, when I bought that car, I remember looking at the gas mileage on it, and it said something like 18 in the city and 26 on the highway.
And the best day you ever had was like 14.
Like, I called the guy, the dealership, after a week, and I was like, dude, something's wrong with this car, because I keep the gas, it's just going through gas like crazy. And he goes, well, are you driving it hard? And I said, it's a WRX. I mean, what else do you do with these things? And he goes, just so you know that when the turbo's flying on that thing, you're getting 9.
Wow.
I'm like, why didn't you tell me that before?
Yeah, I don't think when the EPA test drives those things for mileage, they're driving quite like you are.
No.
Yeah, if they had giant slalom skiers as the test drivers, it would probably change things a lot.
A lot of ski racers, it's true, they go into car racing after they ski. It's just kind of the same, you know, you have the same visual for line and speed and when to speed up and when to slow down. And so, yeah, it's all speed.
So around like age 16, is that where like the competitive element of your career really started ramping up?
No, that was when I was a fetus.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. No, that was when the U.S. ski team, the way they picked the team that year is they basically had a shootout. They invited 30 girls up to Mount Hood. We skied GS for 10 days. On the last 3 days, they had time trials, and they cut 20. And then the final 10 got invited to another camp, and we did sort of the same thing, except it was slalom. And they cut 5, and the final 5 was what they called the junior team. And so I was on the team that went to Europe and raced on the Europa Cup. And that was probably the toughest year of racing I ever had. I had 50 starts that year.
Wow.
And I remember at the end of the season just being so burnt out, and my parents actually calling the team and saying, you know what, she's done, send her home.
Right.
And so, yeah.
So describe for people, because, you know, like I was on the road
for a couple of years, maybe 3 years, pretty much straight between like, you know, being involved with CrossFit, not being involved with CrossFit, and then promoting the book and doing all that sort of stuff. But I, you know, probably on the road about 30 weeks a year traveling, not a ton of international travel, mainly in the States, but give people a little sense of what your travel schedule was like.
Well, the bulk of our travel was in Europe. And so in the fall, we went over for a 4-week camp. We went to Austria to ski. And so we flew over there. We were there, you know, for a long time, came back. And then November 1st, we flew over to do a preseason camp. And we did about a 2-week camp before the season started. And the season generally started in Teen France. And we were there from then until Christmas time. And the Europeans always scheduled the race. They never thought about anyone that might be flying to another continent. So they always would schedule a race on the 23rd, which meant we got to fly back to the States on the 24th. And it usually was a nightmare. It was something like Zurich, Chicago, Chicago, Denver, Denver, Reno. And I would always time it. It took about 24 hours to get home.
Wow.
And we'd have, you know, just enough time to get acclimated back to the States. We'd have 8 to 10 days at home, and then we flew back to Europe on New Year's Day. And we were in Europe till about mid-February. We came home for a week in mid-February, and then we went back over for the spring series, and that usually ended at mid to end of March. And within that time, actually, within that last time, we would fly back to the States or to Japan for races on other continents. So we'd have our Canadian-American races in the spring, and we'd go to Japan in the spring. And then the World Cup finals would be back in Europe. So, and then in the... You had about a month off, like April, May, 2 months off. And then June, you had a ski camp, usually in Bend, Oregon, or at Mount Hood. And then midsummer, we would either go to New Zealand or to South America to train, you know, south of the hemisphere. And so I remember really not having more than 6 weeks at a time at home. And those times were maybe 3 times a year, 4 times, well, 2 times a year, 6 weeks, and then the other times were like under 10 days. So you were living out of a duffel bag pretty much.
Right. And how did you end up finishing up high school out of all that stuff?
Oh, I don't know, but...
yes, you did. I remember.
I did. I took the GED, the good enough degree. I made the team and I was going to private school, and it was the private school's, you know, first couple years in business, and I was their first U.S. ski team athlete. And I remember the first time they sent me, I went on a trip, I had like 7 books, and it was heavy. I usually traveled with 12 pairs of skis, 2 big like hockey duffel bags, and a big backpack with my 7 books. And after that trip, I remember my father going to speak to the headmaster and saying, from now on, she's taking 1 book and she'll study 1 subject at a time over there.
Right.
And that worked out well. And they actually learned something about how they're going to deal with a U.S. ski team athlete. But being in school was a pain in the butt. And I had done a little bit of correspondence work, which now they call homeschooling. But my parents never really helped me. And in that time, I think it was an advantage, you know, with mathematics and algebra. I figured that stuff out. I sat myself down on a desk, and I wanted to be done with school so I could go out and screw off. So I would just concentrate my schooling, do the work, take the test, get done. And so some of my stuff was homeschool, some of my stuff was private school, and my final year was homeschool because I just couldn't take the travel and the training and the working on my skis and the homework all together. And I figured the sooner I graduated, you know, the more I could focus on skiing.
Right, right.
So when did your first kind of, you know, how many times did you make a run at the Olympic team? And then, you know, what was all the kind of rigmarole involved with that? Because it, obviously it's a, you know, both political and highly competitive, you know, kind of gig getting on the team.
Well, in 84, which was Sarajevo, I was young. I was 16 or 17, and I was placing in the top 20 in World Cups, like every race. But at the time, the director of the team had, for Olympics and World Championships, there's usually a protocol on how you make the team. And he very clearly said, no one will be on the Olympic team unless they place in the top 15 on the World Cup. They need, I think, two top 15 finishes. Well, I had like 16th, 16th, 17th, 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 but I didn't have that like golden 15th place. And he decided to stick to his guns, and he left spots open on the Olympic team. The women's slalom team had two spots open, and he didn't fill them because he wanted his criteria met. At that time, I was kind of like, whatever, you know, I'm young. I've got Calgary was the next up. I'm like, that's going to be my games anyway. It's in North America. And things were going well. I was skiing well. I actually, after that year, it was late 87, I was actually in the top three in the World Cup overall standings. And I entered a slalom and just got out of balance, sat back, and my knee blew up. I didn't even fall. And that was it. You know, the Olympic Games was, you know, history. And so I was on the team for 8 years before I went to the Olympics, which was in Albertville in 92. And the syndicates, you know, made a big deal out of that. Like, here's this girl that's been on the team for 8 years, and here she is, finally. Like, just being my first Olympics wasn't enough pressure. They made a story out of it. You know, I did okay in Albertville. I was slated to win a medal, and I actually got quite a bit of press before that. But I'm a big believer in the athletes that get less press usually perform better, just because they're able to focus. And I think that's why a lot of the top athletes now kind of, you know, say, I'm hurt, or don't talk to me, or they have, you know, major guidelines of when they can do press before a big event like the Olympics. So it can be really distracting. And so there was 82, and I got lucky because they wanted to stagger the winter and the summer games. And so 84, Lillehammer came along, so I only had to wait 2 years for that next Olympic Games to come along.
So tell folks that, like, a lot of the stuff that we talk about on here, and, you know, obviously you're familiar with it because you listen to Greg and I to serenade you to sleep most days and stuff like that. But, you know, so we talk a lot about kind of the interface between strength and conditioning, you know, just as a means to an end, versus like the skill acquisition that you need in a specific sport to be successful. I'm kind of playing around with that stuff right now, doing old dude jiu-jitsu. You know, it's like how much in the gym time do I need that is actually going to benefit the jiu-jitsu, you know, relative to actually make inroads into my recovery that isn't really benefiting me. So, you know, what was kind of the mix of like skill work? How did you develop skill work at that point? Because you'd been skiing so long. I mean, it's interesting for me. What did coaching involve at that point? And then also, what role did strength and conditioning play for you? And what type of stuff were you doing? It, you know, in that kind of peak of your career.
Well, I can tell you that when I was young, my mom had me in gymnastics for 3 years. And I think my message to parents is that if you get your kid into one sport, make it gymnastics. Even if they don't make it in the sport, even if it's 1 year or 2 years and, you know, then they struggle a little bit. I think that if you take some gymnastics, pretty much most of the other sports are pretty easy. I was pretty lucky I could catch a ball and throw a ball, but after gymnastics, everything was easy, and I did a ton of other sports, and it just was cake. So then talking about my U.S. ski team career, I was too much of a conformist. In the beginning, they told us to run long distance, and they tested us on the 12-minute run and sit-ups and push-ups and stuff that really wouldn't better your skiing that much. You would think that they would test you on your back squat and your deadlift and maybe some like metabolic conditioning. Later on we did a thing called the box jump. But in the beginning it was kind of like, just if you had endurance, you're going to be a good skier. But as I got older and wiser, I started to do my, and my father was in the background like, what the hell are you doing running? He goes, you need to be lifting weights. And of course you don't listen to your parents. And I was pressured by the team to be good at running cross country. So I was always running. Finally, I listened to my dad and I started to do resistance training and work out on the track and do some track and field work. And, but I always felt guilty about it because it wasn't what the team was recommending. And finally, when the team did recommend those things, I did them. And there was a point where they paid for me to take gymnastics twice a week here in Santa Cruz with the local gymnasium. And so I did, like, all the things we talk about on this podcast, strength, interval training, that's pretty much what a skier should be doing. You need to do probably a little bit more lateral stuff. When I was talking about box jumps, you know, our familiarity with box jumps is you have the box in front of you and you jump straight up on it and jump down. The U.S. ski team test was a 90-second test where the box was on your side. It was a 20-inch box. You jumped up on the box and down on the other side and then the other way. And it was horrible. But that was actually a decent test for skiing because it was lateral and, you know, you had that little plyo factor in there. And I generally was an overtrainer all through my skiing career. If I had the brain that I have now and the body I had then, I think I would have been, I hate to say, you know, coulda, shoulda, woulda, but I think I would have been a more successful skier.
You know, you've talked about that in hanging out with Greg and I, you know, multiple situations. You've talked about that, and I think that it's a really interesting piece to all this stuff. You know, people look at like the training loads of say like a Lance Armstrong, or, you know, they pick your kind of guru in a particular sport, and then folks try to emulate what it is that person is doing. You know, which can have all kinds of limitations based on the fact that they're not genetically, you know, there's a big genetic selection that goes on with all that stuff. But it's so intriguing to me that, you know, in looking back, you really feel like if you had taken more time off, if you hadn't pushed so hard on like the supportive strength and conditioning stuff, that you would have probably been more fresh for the actual events that you needed to do. Could you talk a little bit about that? I think it's really important for folks to kind of take that in, that, you know, the strength and conditioning stuff needs to support the activity and not undermine it.
Exactly. And the activity needs to take precedence. And my attitude, you know, I was a very dedicated person, and my attitude was, you know, my motto was leave no stone unturned. When you stand in the starting gate, you should have no regrets. You shouldn't be looking back and going, thinking, should I have squatted more? Should I have trained harder? Should I have skied on these skis? You know, I always said, leave no stone unturned so that when you're in the starting gate, you have no doubts. And so I worked very hard. I never missed a training program, And on top of that, I loved windsurfing. So I'd be like in the weight room in the morning, bike intervals in the afternoon. And then at 4, I'd drive up to Waddell Creek and windsurf for 3 hours. And looking back, I just remember how I felt in the beginning of the season. And one was mostly mentally scorched, you know, just really nervous, really the fear factor was higher, and all the things that an exhausted person, you know, if you're an infant, you cry. Right. And if you're an adult, you have a lot of these other manifestations that come up when you are overtrained. And to me, the first one was, you know, mental, and being able to handle the pressure. And the difference
between just look at your travel schedule,
right?
You know, and so if you're going into the whole season a little bit crispy already, and like if you were just a business person traveling to the degree that you were doing, that would crush most people, you know?
Right. And you know, at that time, I look back on it, I'm like, thank God for youth. You know, that's the only thing that got me through. But I know two things. One is the years I blew out my knee. And all I was doing was rehab on my knee, and it forced me to slow down. My years after that, I always kicked ass. I always kicked ass. I had something to prove. I wasn't able to overtrain because I was in pain, and it held me back. And the third thing is that the people, I'm not going to mention their names, but the people who were winning World Cups at that time, I always call them dead wood. Like, they didn't train. In the summer, when the season was over, they chilled out, sat on the couch, and did nothing. And it was really hard for me to know that no training could give me better results than overtraining. And I believe that almost today, especially for a skier, and if you're in a high-level sport, that overtraining is so detrimental, and it is more detrimental than undertraining.
Well, but you've had that same experience more recently too, though. You've talked to me about having gotten a little carried away from time to time, and then backing off, and ending up coming back so much better, and making big PRs, and just feeling better in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a phase too, where I was going for big, like where I am now. I'm not really searching for too much performance. I have a baseline, and I get my movements in. But like, performance is so, I just look at that word, and it's way, way, way to the side. I like to perform well, but I'm not concerned about, you know, PRing and putting it on the board and telling people what I did. I'm just happy to be healthy and moving. And, anyway, I have this vision of training in Chico with you guys, and I remember I was doing like some crazy workout, and I remember you and Rob standing in the parking lot, and I kept running laps around, and you guys were like, she's crazy.
sit down.
And you guys were right. You were right. Then I was like, just, I don't know, I call it squirrel. When you
squirrel?
Just, you can't,
dude, you are both moose and squirrel.
I call people who can't stop training, that can just not sit still and like think about doing a quality training program versus just like running around and getting as many mad moves in that you can. I tend to get kind of spun up about that. And so now I just, when I see that happening, I just say squirrel.
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 You know what? I want to talk a bunch about what you've been doing with your own strength and conditioning and the website that you have and the consulting you're doing. But I think for people to appreciate the perspective that you have, you know, you just mentioned, and it really kind of impacted me. You're like, I'm just happy to be healthy and mobile. And so talk to people a little bit about you've had 8-10 major surgeries on your knee.
I've had 8 knee surgeries.
Okay.
So
it would be impressive if it were 10, but 8.
It's a little limp weenie, but we'll run
it.
It
is a little limp weenie. Yeah. Well, I count microfractures as 2, mm-hmm. really. So I've blown both ACLs, both lateral meniscus, both MCLs, separate times. And when Dr. Stedman was my doctor, he would try to repair as much as he could and remove as little as he could. And but what happens when your menisci are not perfectly smooth and virgin is they start to wear on that condyle in the femur. And so what happened with me is that it wore on the femur, and on one side, I popped a quarter-sized piece of my articular cartilage off the femur, and on the other side, I just wore it down to be thin. And the surgeries for that was called a microfracture, and they go in, and it's a scope, this surgery, but they take an ice pick and they pound the end of your femur to try to get some scar tissue to protect the bone there. And those were 12-week non-weight bearing. I think I had to be something like 12 to 18 hours in a CPM machine. Mm. And it was hard times. And looking back at that, and if you look at my right knee x-ray right now, it's not a pretty picture. It looks like I'm like first in line for a knee replacement, but it doesn't hurt. And I have a good quality of life, and I can do the things I love to do. You guys know I love to surf, and I can do everything I love to do. And it, as long as I can keep my knees healthy and I can keep mobile and doing the things that I love to do, I'm staying away from the knife, and I'm going to continue to try to work out and not do anything stupid. I just can't afford it.
So now, do you think, and I know this is really kind of impossible to answer, but I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts at this point in your life. Do you think those injuries and that kind of residual damage can be attributed to your chosen sport in general? Or do you think you were just not adequately prepared because of the type of training you were doing at that time?
Or over-prepared.
Right. I think it was a little bit of both. The statistic that the U.S. ski team had out at the time is if you were on the U.S. ski team for over 5 years, you had a 98% chance of an ACL rupture.
Hmm. Sounds about right.
And so I was on for 12 years, so I had two. So I was right on the statistic. The first time I blew out my knee out, I think I was really quad dominant. Hmm. I never remember doing anything to work my hamstrings. I remember everything was kind of back. I was front squatting. I was squatting. I was leg pressing. I was doing one-legged stuff, but, you know, I wasn't deadlifting. And I wasn't practicing very much flexibility, and I just really think that my quads were huge and I had puny hamstrings. And when I sat back in that position and fired my quadriceps, that literally blew my knee out. And and so in the first instance, I think it was statistics plus a lack of correct training. And the second time, I think it was statistics mostly. I flew off a jump, and I mean, I was still people falling skiing, like getting your car up to, you know, 70 miles an hour on the freeway and just opening the door and jumping out, you know. How do you like that? And then, you know, except we're doing it with poles and skis strapped to our feet. So, I mean, if you take a dive going 70, 80 miles an hour, if coming out and being able to walk away from it is really a gift.
Yeah, that soft snow starts feeling pretty hard at that speed.
Yeah, and you know, if you ever get a chance to go to a World Cup race, the snow is like tile. I mean, it's they have this thing called an injection system where they go down the course and they inject water into the snow and then it freezes overnight. So basically, if they could run Zambonis on ski race hills, they would.
Oh, that's part of what I like about watching those races is that sound of them coming down the hill.
Yeah, the chattering.
You can tell how slick it is just from the sound. It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I have head injuries from that, not knowing it. You know that?
No.
We call it rattle bucket. You know, and you just come down the hill and your head was just rattling in your helmet, and you're like, ugh.
You got adult onset shaken baby syndrome.
Yes.
Well, and you mentioned that, like, your QL and your all the muscles that kind of keep your torso from ripping off of your pelvis were, like, huge.
Yeah, I remember people looking at my back, and I had these, like, two tree trunks back there. And when I retired from racing, I just always felt my back. And I feel my back now, and it's just like a regular back. It's sad. I remember having to curve my fingers down and by my SI joints on both sides to, if I want to put my hands on my hips or on my back there. And I'm doing it right now. It's not, no bueno.
So, Eva, so you were one of the first people to really start training with Greg Glassman in the early kind of incarnation of the CrossFit scene. Tell people about that.
Well, I think it was 97 or 98. I can't remember, but I was retired from ski racing, and I was doing these like made for television ski events, which I still had to ski well for, and the money was awesome. You know, everyone thinks I was a pro skier, but if you're an Olympic skier, you're considered amateur. So once I retired, I got to do races like, you know, ski with the celebrities and the MCI challenge, where they took ski racers that were on the team and they put us together and had us race post-career. But the money pots were huge. And so I was trying to stay in shape for that. And I was taking spin classes to get my interval training in. And who was my spin instructor? Greg Glassman. And he was the only guy that didn't, like, get you on the bike and put on, you know, some funky music and have you just grind away for an hour. He did actual interval training, and I really liked that. And, you know, after class, he's like, hey, you should do some training with me. And I was always resistant. And we were at this cheesy place called Spa Fitness.
Mm-hmm.
And
sounds hardcore.
It was so hardcore. He's like, and I kind of just blew it off for a long time. And finally I was like, okay, I'll train with you. And so I remember my first workout with Greg. I did air squats, toes to bar, and toes to bar, like, he made me do toes to bar with straight arms, dead hang, straight legs, pointed toes, instep to the bar. So, mm-hmm. And then I did some back extension and some lunges. And the workout was great. It was a blast. It was, I'd done a ton of circuit training through my ski racing career, but this was like being able to integrate the gymnastics and the air squats. It was fun. It was really fun, and I loved it. And so I was on his schedule, and I trained with Greg, and he's moved from Spa Fitness. Well, so he got asked to leave Spa Fitness. He was toying with the Olympic lifts with me, and I was clean and jerking in Spa Fitness, and they of course didn't have bumper plates, and I missed like 115-pound jerk, which is embarrassing to say right now, but I was only, I mean, people were like, wow, what's that? But I missed it and I dumped it, and it was a big crash. Bumper plates
sound awesome.
Yeah. And so they were like, I think that after that they just said, you know what, buddy, your risk in here is too high versus the benefit. And I remember I was supposed to train with Greg, and he said, let's go eat breakfast first. And I sat down with him. He's like, dude, they asked me to leave Spa Fitness. And he goes, I don't even know what I'm going to tell Lauren. You know, I'm afraid to go home. And I said, you know what? Start your own thing and it's going to be okay. Not knowing that it was going to be okay, and just trying to be supportive, you know. And
shit.
I'll keep that in mind whenever you give me a pep talk in the future. You're like, I just want to get off the phone. Like, so yeah.
No. I mean, I didn't know. And this was a time when Greg and Lauren, they didn't have a car. They just rode their bikes everywhere.
Right.
Rain or shine. And then, you know, he started his own little gym at a jiu-jitsu place. And I remember we didn't have any equipment. I do remember we had one of those Schwinn,
Airdynes,
and I remember that's pretty much the closest to hurling I've ever been. And he did some interval thing with me on that, and I remember holding on to the wall to get outside, and he was really sweet. He's like, sweetie, you all right? I'm like, I don't even know what that thing just did to me, but I just felt like, yeah, I got it. I got it hard. So, and then we moved to a little bigger place. We got a little equipment, and Greg's like, you should just start teaching some classes. And so I taught free classes for a while that I would work out in myself. And then I started teaching classes and charging $5 a head, and kind of, it just evolved from there.
And this was around maybe 99, 2000, 2001, maybe, that all that was going on.
Yeah, and then I think I met you and Greg in 02 maybe, 01 or 02, and I remember it's when the certifications were still like in the teens as far as how many people were there.
Right.
And I remember you did a talk, and I was like, wow, who's that?
Man, that guy's propeller was spinning super fast.
He's got some brain cells. And super excited, and I really...
A little too heavy on the science, kid.
Professorial.
But I really liked that. I appreciated that. And so...
You know, those early days with the certs, like, you know, obviously I've had all kinds of in and out with the CrossFit scene and my relationship with Glassman and all that. But those early days, it was amazing. Like, Glassman was a phenomenal speaker. The stuff that he put together for those certs and the breadth of his knowledge and the way that he could convey material and really get you excited about the whole thing. Like, it was amazing. Some of the most exciting stuff that I'd ever done in my life, still to this day. Like, it was amazing, amazing times.
They were great times. I was talking to Rutt the other day, and we were talking about the 7th Avenue cert, and those were good, just dang good times, and I will never forget them. And but we were so, and Greg was so effective with his speaking that I would say that we were all squirrel.
Yeah.
We were all like, doing handstands on the pavement, and, you know, showing off all our mad moves any moment we had, and it was great.
You know, it's interesting though. Like, around that time, I think Greg was still he has this really great kind of grasp of economics and markets and stuff like that, and I think that. You know, he had a lot of overlap in the thinking of like Art Devaney and the early incarnations of CrossFit. Like, it was horrible, but as far as like the physiological response you have, but he was really thinking a lot about what was the minimum that you could do, particularly like almost an art form of what could I write on a piece of paper, you know, or like the workout of the day that was posted. How could I write this thing so that it has like the minimum amount of wordage or whatever. I was just reading something that when Dr. Seuss wrote The Cat in the Hat, it only has 206 words that are used in the whole book. And, you know, and obviously they use them multiple times, but then Green Eggs and Ham only has like 50 words used in the whole book. And so he had a bet with his, Dr. Seuss had a bet with his publisher that he could write an even better book with like 50 words or something like that. And it makes me think of, some of that early programming, which is where stuff like the Diane workouts and Helen and these things that had a really wicked bite to it, but it had this kind of minimum dose, maximum effectiveness, and which I think you've really adopted a ton of that. And, you know, as CrossFit has grown into the sport of fitness, and I you know, oddly enough, I think it's really cool. I think that stuff's awesome, but I think a little piece has been kind of lost in that, and the forgetting of this idea of let's figure out what's the minimum dose that we could do that's going to move us, either maintain where we are, you know, like if you're in a competitive ski environment or doing jiu-jitsu or something, or if you're going to make progress, what's the minimum amount I could do versus what's the maximum I could do and still survive it, which is to some degree kind of what it's grown into, you know?
Yeah. And we took pride in like how short and effective it was. And, you know, over time I've learned what a very sharp tool CrossFit is and how little CrossFit you can do and still maintain and even sometimes get better. I think that sometimes isn't looked at. And that's my new mission, especially, I hate to admit this, but I am getting older. as you get older, you really, you know, you start to feel things a lot more, your recovery drops a little bit, and, you know, you move on in your life. You do things like you've written a book and Greg's got this great business going on. You just don't have time to just think about working out all day, you know? And so, I've had a lot of reflection on this whole thing, being an Olympic athlete and, you know, going through my CrossFit and my Olympic weightlifting experiences. And I've realized, and through you've got to really take a hard look at what you're doing, because that's not why you're working out, is to go have shoulder surgery. So I took a hard look at that, and I thought, you know, the minimum effective dose is the way to go. Even for a skier, even for an Olympic skier, wouldn't you think that doing the minimum effective dose would leave so much room for mental acuity, dealing with pressure, dealing with travel, dealing with stress, all those factors? You know, what I'm learning, I'm also in a functional medicine internship now, that stress is stress is stress. Whether it's food, whether it's sleep, whether it's travel, whether it's exercise, your body processes that as one thing. And so I think in something that's supposed to be good for you, like working out, it should be just that. It should be good for you. It shouldn't spill over into a place where you're hurt or that it's become an added stress in your life.
So I think people forget too that the amount of work that is going to be the minimum effective dose is going to change over time. You know, when you're younger, it's going to keep increasing for a while as you get adapted to it. So if you start with this super huge amount of work, you're going to be screwed in the long term, because there's going to be a point where, like you said, it's going to spill over and you simply can't do it.
Exactly. And at that point, when you get to the point where you can't handle the volume, the mistake people make is they think, well, now I've got to go harder because I'm just not getting the gains anymore. But that's the time to start looking at some other things. You know, that's the time where you got to say, now do I take a right turn or a left turn? Do I need to start lifting more? Do I need to do more skill work? Or do I need to get out and do a sport? You know, the stimulus has to change. And it doesn't mean that you go back to doing a ton of it. But I think that people really need to open their minds and look at the big picture, because we're so myopic now. Like, I just got to get, you know, string together 10 muscle ups. It's like, no, like, get one beautiful one. And where's the 10 muscle ups going to get you in the big picture of your life? Is it going to make you better at your job? Is it going to make you a better mother or father?
It's gonna make people love me.
It's, you know, and so I think that that's where I call these people, and I'm not trying to steal from your food thing, but the evolved athlete. I've been writing some blog posts about being evolved, doing your modality of training, whether it's CrossFit or P90X or whatever the heck you do, and just opening your eyes to the big picture and evolving and wanting more. That's where people come to, you know, Greg Everett or Rob Wolf or whoever else, or me, whoever else is out there that want just a little bit more structure and beaten path to their what their training is doing for them. And I say that those are evolved trainees. They're people who've just done it. They're just kind of not getting anywhere. They might have been hurt. They don't feel like they need to perform. They don't need to put any results up on the board. They just want to be healthy, but they want to be doing smart, fun things that help them feel productive in their training and productive towards their life in general.
And Eva's been rattling on this stuff for probably 5-6 years, and my foot has interacted with her backside multiple times. Everybody has a different perspective on this. And like, I've got my perspective, Greg's got his perspective. I was a middling athlete, you know, competing in powerlifting. Greg's done some cool stuff in Olympic lifting and whatnot. But, you know, when I always feel kind of humbled and also want to kind of take a little bit of a step back let someone like you, Eva, or John Wellborn, you know, John played in the NFL for 10 years straight and at a very, very high, basically the highest level that you could in that scene. And so it's always intriguing to me to have somebody who was in that athletic scene, literally at the highest level that you could compete at in the world, and then see that, okay, you guys have kind of arrived at similar spots that I have, but I never had the athletic accomplishments that you guys have. And so I think that your insight on this stuff is just really valuable, and it's another voice kind of, you know, saying these same things, but there's a certain validity that comes from someone like you, you know, when you've done so much and you've worked so hard, you know, you've gone through all these surgeries and the rehab and all the rest of that. So it's coming from a really different place, and it's really powerful. And so I've actually been goosing Eva for a long time to put more of her thinking on this stuff out there and to make herself available to do consulting for folks. And you've been getting quite a bit of response off that.
Yeah. And I have to thank you for that. I mean, you've always said I'm like Polish stubborn. I'm like a mule, and man, you had to stuff your foot pretty far up my ass to get moving. And I did. And I thank you for that. And it's what I need to do. And thank you. I mean, it's great to know that, you know, that my experiences are confirming for other people. But one of the reasons is, I think for John and I, we had such a volume of experience that one of the things that people forget is that, you know, we're not pointing the finger. We just had a huge opportunity to do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And I think when you do something wrong, you learn it almost better than anyone. And, you know, I just want to steer people away from, I think it's my responsibility to steer people away and using my experience from doing it wrong, from making the same mistakes that I made. And I can smell those mistakes coming up. You know, when you have clients in the gym, you can just see the future on those things if you've experienced it yourself. And I would say to people, I'm not pointing the finger at you. I'm just telling you, because I've already fucked it all up. Everything you could do wrong, I've done it wrong. I've eaten wrong. I've slept wrong. I used to say sleep is for pussies, and, you know, and I used to have, you know, a cocky attitude, and all those things have just kicked me in the ovaries. And so that's why I do have some maybe legitimate things to say, because I've actually experienced doing it wrong and then learning how to do it correctly. And I think it's a lifelong journey, but I think I'm gonna finally at this age finally figure it out.
And you know, one of the most recent things you just mentioned, it that you're doing a functional medicine intern with Dr. Dan Kalish, and that was kind of at the end of a fair amount of tinkering that you were doing, trying to figure out some kind of wacky blood work and some energy stuff that you had going on that you know, I couldn't really figure out. You couldn't really figure it out. We had some pieces to it, but tell folks a little bit about that.
Well, that was your fault too. No, I had to get a life insurance policy, and I had to get some lab work done, and it came out funky. And I sent it to you, Rob, and he's like, "You were like, what are you, a closet cookie monster? What are these numbers?" I'm like, "I don't know. I'm eating better than I ever have in my life." And so I was like on a 1.5 year journey between doctors and hematologists, and there was some problems going on. I had a tumor on my thyroid, and I was like, man, this isn't what an Olympic athlete should be doing. I should be like the picture of health, which is a message I say to people. Just because you're an athlete doesn't give you a certificate of health. In fact, you need to look forward to some some crazy shit down the road health-wise. And I was going through that. And I realized that it was time in my life to start to heal myself. I mean, I'm not trying to get kumbaya on you, but just basically I had wrecked myself. I was pretty close to stage 3 adrenal insufficiency, thyroid problem, and constant body pain. And so I saw a functional medicine doctor here in Santa Cruz who was an MD. She ran a bunch of tests. I started to kind of hook on to what she was doing, kind of corresponded with some of the things you were saying. And I was like, I really am intrigued with this stuff. And we decided to get a second opinion from Dr. Kalish. And I looked around his website and I saw he had an internship. And I said, do you have to have an MD to do your mentorship? And he said, no, you could do it. And so there I went. I signed up. And now that's one thing I feel like I'm offering with my services from my website is I hate to use the word holistic. I am turning into a hippie. You guys know that. No.
We already sent you some patchouli, so you're cool.
I'm trying not to. I'm trying to put on a good face. But, but you know, I'm doing the testing and I'm trying to offer for my clients, you know, some pre-testing before I send them a program. I mean, if your adrenals are smoked, I'm not going to have you do too much metabolic conditioning. I'm going to have a specific protocol for each level of adrenal insufficiency. And I integrate that. And some of the people I'm programming for, I did ASI tests on them and they came back no bueno. And I was like, forget what I sent you last week. I got to redo this and I have to send them a new program. But I think that that's going to get more popular. And I think it is important to do because if you're writing training programs for people who are smoked, especially distance programming, you know, the first premise as a trainer should be do no harm. And I'm really happy I have this opportunity to give them a test like that. Not that it answers everything, but gives me a good idea of what their stress levels are like.
And then how to tweak some lifestyle and food and sleep.
Right.
It's funny. This thing has done is just kind of given some hard numbers looking under the hood for, I mean, it really doesn't change prescriptions a ton, not in the big macro level, but you're able to dial it in much more specific for the person, you know. And for a lot of people, this is some stuff that I've been talking about for a long time. For a lot of people who are scorched, they have no business going down that like glycolytic pathway, the kind of classic Metconning type stuff. They can lift some weights. They can do some kind of cardio via a variety of activities, whether it's surfing or walking or, you know, just some very well-planned intervals, you know, where you're only breathing through your nose instead of like, you know, like right. We've all done, you know, leaning over and heaving partway during the training. But that stuff becomes critical to pull these people out of the hole.
I lost you a little bit there, but yeah, I think that having the big picture is important. I'm one person that was smoked and I didn't even know it. And the tricky thing is that with people who are in a stage 3 adrenal burnout, working out in that glycolytic cycle makes them feel good for a couple hours after the workout. That's why you can kind of smell it when someone's really smoked. They were like, I gotta work out. And it's because their cortisol comes up a little bit and they're at the point where they're deficient. They can't even secrete enough. And so when they exercise, they get it up and they feel normal for a couple hours, but then they crash again. So, you know, and then I've also found that that messes with your, brain chemicals as well. And so I'm also doing brain balancing, which I found out that my dopamine and my serotonin were very low, and I'm working on that as well. And that's been a new frontier.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. And, you know, the things that we've talked about before and Kresser talked about it, Stefan Guiney has talked about some of this stuff, but you can get these changes in, you know, like gut health from bad food, which then kind of works its way in a stress manifestation kind of direction that ends up in affecting neurochemistry in a negative way. Or you could have neurochemistry affected by lack of sleep, maybe even food from, like, you know, permeable gut, permeable brain type stuff. But then that ends up backfilling and it negatively affecting endocrine status, like thyroid and cortisol, and also gut health. And so it's kind of interesting that you could have these problems being caused either from northbound direction, southbound direction, and it's kind of hard to pin down exactly what the
the causative factor is sometimes when you have people who are stressed out on so many different levels. They're not sleeping enough. Their food is bad. They have a stressful work environment. They're addicted to these metabolic conditioning sessions because that session is the only thing that makes them feel a little bit better for a little while. And so then when you suggest taking that away, it's really hard.
Yeah. And I always try to get people to the understanding about the immunoglobulin A, the SIG A being intact, and, you know, using the example of, you know, people who get constant sinus infections. And that's a huge sign your SIG A is permeable. And how does your SIG A get permeable? There's a million ways it can happen. You know, it's stress, it's food stress, it can be exercise stress, but, I think you've talked about it more than anyone, is that immunoglobulin A in the gut and how critical that is for health in general and how many different things can break that down and let, you know, these whatever into your system, random antigens, viruses, big protein particles that are hard to for your liver to metabolize. Those all gunk up your system, and then you've got this other satellite over here, the brain stuff, and it's all connected, and we've really done a fabulous job at like screwing those things up.
Right.
And it's a deep hole to dig ourselves out of. It takes time, it takes patience, but for the most part it takes people to realize they're going to have to stop doing things they like to do and do things that they need to do. Mm. And once they start doing the things they need to do, they might start liking them because they'll feel better.
Actually feel good. So, yeah. So Eva, how do folks track you down?
My website is evatstrengthandconditioning.com. If you go there, there is a services menu. I'm not a stripper, but I do almost everything else.
Perfect.
I knew I had to put something like that into the podcast.
You have to leave something for Greg and I to do, so we'll stick to the stripping. So
okay. So I do everything from consulting to programming. You can sign up to have me ski with you. You know, all kinds of good stuff. We can do an ASI test on you. I do GI tests. And I'm working under Dr. Kalish. I'll be done with my certification in April. Also on that site, there is a Get Started page. And I wanted to let people know that if you fill out that page, you are communicating with me. And I'm expecting that you are asking me for services. I think some people have been using it kind of as a journal. And I get these emails like, hey, I'm 27, I like long walks on the beach, blah, blah, blah. And then I call them back and never hear from them again. So it's definitely a sign-up sheet, and we're going to make that more clear. And then I have my blog, and now I very much understand the life of a blogger. And congratulations to both of you. But now I'm suffering through writing something meaningful every week, and it's been challenging, but very enhancing for my own knowledge. Well,
there's the mistake you're making, is you're trying to make them meaningful.
That's just way too high of standard. Yeah, that creates stress.
Next year I'll make them not as meaningful. I'm going to try to do a period of time where I, you know, write something meaningful. And then sometimes I'll, you know, my manager always says, hey, just link to a good article you found, write a little synopsis on it and put it in the can. And I'm like, I don't want to do too much of that, but And then I have those dentistry articles. So if people have questions on dentistry, I'm kind of a paleo dental hygienist. So
make sure you floss.
Make sure you floss.
If you don't floss, you're going to have systemic inflammation and die.
Right. Only floss the teeth you want to keep.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't floss every day, it's like not wiping your butt after you poop.
Eva is a firm believer in gum control.
That's right. Gum control. That's right. I need to make a t-shirt out of that. That's good.
You should.
That is. Can I steal that, Greg?
No, I stole it from that movie Schizopolis.
Oh.
The one where Steven Soderbergh went nuts.
I think it's incredible. I need
a... For those of you who haven't seen it, you need to go see it.
It's a good time.
You will not understand any of it the first, like, 12 times you watch it. Then it'll start to make sense.
One of those...
Yes.
I'm just super stoked that Eva has finally popped her head up on the radar and is offering her strength and conditioning and consulting services. Like I said, this has been a long time coming. This is it's hard to goad the Polish princess into doing something until she's ready to do it. So I'm really stoked that Eva's doing this. I'm very excited that the folks who listen to the podcast are, you know, that Eva will be more on her radar. I know that we've mentioned Eva probably a couple of hundred times on here, but it kind of pales in comparison just secondhand relating some of your experiences versus folks being able to interact with you directly. So I'm really excited.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I have to say, sometimes when I'm listening to you guys and I do get a little whiff that you may be talking about me, my jaw drops. I'm like, oh, I got to go on and defend myself.
Yeah, it's over. It's like my name is being destroyed. So
no,
I'm surprised you haven't sent us a cease and desist yet. So.
Oh, well, that's coming.
Yeah.
I get my lawyers on those. No, thank you so much, though. I had a blast.
Awesome, Teve, sir. Well, I'm stoked you came on today. I'm sure folks will have more questions for you down the road, so maybe we'll look at getting you back on here in the spring or summer or something like that.
Yeah, we should do a video one.
We could do it. We could all meet in Sunnyvale and hang out with Greg.
There you Sunnyvale?
Go. Let's go someplace warm. Let's make it a trip where we have to go to a beach
instead of the taste of bathing suit.
It's already enough work as it is, Eva. Let's not add travel to it also.
I would go to Baja to
You're
do a
buzzkill.
Podcast.
You're buzzkill. No, it would be nice. It would be in Baja, a little shots of tequila in the sun.
I like
waves
it.
In the background.
I'm in. That's lit. I may not come back, so.
Awesome,
guys. Well, Greg, anything you need to let folks know is cooking in Catalyst Athletics land, or is everything still, level 4 security clearance right now?
It's all under wraps still. It's coming.
Cool. Well, awesome, Eva. Thanks for being on, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, guys.
Okay. Bye.
See ya.